Well, in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, where this season's Summer Studio Theater Company benefit on July 21st and 22nd offers a performance of the play Broadway, coupled with a musical review of Prohibition-era songs. For more information about the benefit and the final weeks of performances of My Three Angels, Last of the Red Hot Way, visit KrannertCenter.com. Support for today's broadcast comes from the Seaboat, with a southern style of cooking catfish, chicken, and shrimp, featuring the Seaboat Sandwich, two pieces of fish on a wheat bun with lettuce, tomato, and tartar sauce, and desserts like sweet potato pie. The Seaboat at Bradley and Market in Champaign. Delivery and catering services at 351-6209.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580 and online at WILL.UIUC.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. A news story that has the attention of many of us at the moment is who will be named to fill the first vacancy on the U.S. Supreme Court in more than a decade? Who will succeed Justice Sandra Day O'Connor? What will a new justice mean for the court? How different will it be? Today, with the help of journalist Linda Greenhouse, we'll take a look at the court and how it works. Linda Greenhouse has covered the U.S. Supreme Court for the New York Times since 1978. She won the Pulitzer Prize in 1998 for her coverage of the court. She began working at the Times in 1968 when University of Illinois alumnus James Rustin hired her as his assistant. Linda Greenhouse is the author of a new book that examines Harry Blackmun's tenure on the High Court, titled Becoming Justice Blackmun, Harry Blackmun's Supreme Court Journey. The focus of the book is on Justice Blackmun, best known for writing the court's opinion in Roe v. Wade, but readers will also get a good sense of how the court works. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion with your questions and comments. Join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free 800-222-9455. 800-222-9455. WILL. In addition to her work as a senior writer at the New York Times, Linda Greenhouse appears regularly on the PBS program Washington Week. You can see that program on our companion station Friday evenings at 7 o'clock. Her book, Becoming Justice Blackmun, Harry Blackmun's Supreme Court Journey, is published by Times Books. Again, the phone numbers 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free 800-222-9455. Linda Greenhouse, thank you so much for joining me this afternoon.
Oh, thanks for having me, Celeste.
I do want to focus most of our conversation this afternoon on becoming Justice Blackmun, but I do want to get your thoughts about, you know, what will a new justice mean for the court? How different will it be? And who do you think might succeed Sandra Day O'Connor?
Well, I'm not going to get into a guessing game. You know, I'm not inside the president's head. Obviously, it's an important vacancy because she did hold the balance of power on many, many issues. So, you know, there's a lot in play. Pretty much anything that one might care about at the Supreme Court is something that Justice O'Connor really had a hand in and had the balance of power in. So this is a nomination that could certainly shape the court for the coming years.
Okay. Well, let's talk about how it was that you were given access to the papers of Justice Blackmun. You were given early access to his papers.
Yes. Harry Blackmun saved everything. He was really a pack rat. He served on the court for 24 years, but he didn't come to the court until he was in the 60s, so he had a lot of time to save things running up to the court. And when he died, he left all the papers to the Library of Congress, 500,000 documents, with the stipulation that the collection could be open to the world 5 years after his death. And his family was just a little bit concerned that, given the high-profile nature of some of his work on the court, you mentioned Roe against Wade, other cases having to do with abortion, sex discrimination, and so on, there would be just a big media frenzy when the papers open. Everybody sort of grabbing the folders of the hot cases and this kind of thing, and that no serious reporting could really come out of an atmosphere like that. So they invited me to spend 2 months ahead of time in the collection and just go through it in whatever way I was going to go through it and do whatever I was going to do, but just in the sort of quiet reading time there in the Library of Congress. And so that's what I did in the winter of 2004. The papers opened in March of 2004. And I did a series for the New York Times, 3 articles, and then that led to this book.
Yeah. The opening sentence to the prologue for Becoming Justice Blackmun reads, "Justice Harry A. Blackmun gave the country a great gift." Do you know why he decided that everything should be open to the public and within a relatively short period of time after his death?
Right. I mean, the surprising thing was not that he opened his papers. Many justices have their papers open at the Library of Congress, but it was a very short interval. And it feels even shorter because he's the last justice to have retired before Justice O'Connor. He retired in 1994, and he certainly had no reason to expect, and none of us would have a reason to expect, that 11 years later it would basically be the same court that he left, except for, of course, his own successor, which is Justice Stephen Breyer. So the material has a very immediate feel because it's the same cast of characters. And why he did that, well, as I say, I don't think he expected that it would be quite so similar. And he had a need that was demonstrated at many points in his life to sort of to make a record. I think he felt that if he saved all this stuff and gave it to the country, people would be able to come along and make some sense of it and put it in perspective and, you know, maybe raise it out of the kind of pushing and shoving of the current controversies and that kind of thing. And, you know, we'll see if he proves to be right.
Yeah. That's very interesting. Years ago, he was still on the court, and I attended a dedication ceremony for the law school at Southern Illinois University at Carbondale, and he granted the press there a news conference.
Mm-hmm. When was that?
It was in the 80s. Forgive me, I don't know. I can't remember when it was exactly, but it was in the 1980s, and it was something that was unheard of.
Right, right. Yeah, these days it's a little less unheard of. Some of them are a little bit more accessible. But, he felt a need and would take occasions to explain himself. I think he felt, for much of his career, quite misunderstood. He was, of course, demonized on the anti-abortion side as the person who, you know, created the right to abortion in America and so on. He got the hate mail and the death threats, and it never really made a lot of sense to him because people may not remember that Roe against Wade was decided by a vote of 7-2.
Mm-hmm.
And there were some quite conservative justices like Chief Justice Warren Burger who were in the majority. In fact, it was Burger in his role as Chief Justice who assigned Blackmun to write the majority opinion. So Blackmun viewed himself as not having, you know, sort of come up with something off the top of his head and foisted it on the court and on the country, but as someone who discharged an assignment to speak for a strong majority of the court. And he would insist on this over the years, although over the years he did inevitably reach a very personal attachment to the decision and really dedicated himself to defending it as his handiwork.
Hmm. He didn't think that it would stand as long as it has, and he delayed his retirement, did he not?
Yes, yes. He felt on at several points in the late 80s and early 90s that a new majority had come onto the court that was going to vote to overturn Roe against Wade, and he was plenty surprised when it didn't happen. In 1992, in the Planned Parenthood against Casey decision, which reaffirmed the right to abortion with the very crucial votes of 3 of the recently appointed by Republican presidents, Justice O'Connor and Justice Kennedy and Justice Souter, Blackmun was certainly surprised and relieved.
Mm. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon is Linda Greenhouse. She covers the U.S. Supreme Court for the New York Times. She is the author of Becoming Justice Blackmun, Harry Blackmun's Supreme Court Journey. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with your questions. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We have a listener waiting to talk with us on line 1 in Monticello. Go ahead.
Hi, I'd like to ask you a question in reference to the abortion decision, because what you just said contradicts some of your writing, and it has relevance to the medical marijuana decision that just came down from the court. My understanding from reading your work was that Blackmun was not actually asserting the right of a woman to have an abortion, but was in fact asserting the right of a physician to make decisions independent of government interference. At least that was what it was initially. So I have a question is, how did it get to be changed from being a physician's right decision to being a woman's right decision? And would he, since he did essentially adopt that woman's right position later in his life, as he kept changing his mind on many issues, what would his feeling have been about the medical marijuana decision? Would he support that as a physician's right to prescribe the necessary medicine, or not?
Good questions.
Yeah, good question. No, you're quite right. I mean, not only Blackmun, but the court, the majority in Roe against Wade, did think that what they were vindicating, to use the verb at the toward the end of the opinion, was the right of doctors to act in what they thought was the best interest of their patients without being hauled off to jail. I don't think I said anything that contradicted that. And what's one of the fascinating things about his career is how that stance kind of, and that understanding of what they were creating in Roe against Wade did morph over time into a broad charter, you might say, of women's rights. And when Blackmun, at his final day press conference, where he appeared with President Clinton announcing his retirement, when he was asked to pass some kind of final judgment on Roe against Wade, or I forget how the question was actually phrased, and he said it was a step that needed to be taken on the road to the emancipation of women, which was, of course, very fascinating, because that's not the road that he thought he was going down. And it's just, it's interesting to see, and it's too kind of complex to just answer over the phone like this, but see the interplay of the abortion cases, and there were a number of those, and the sex discrimination cases that were coming to the court simultaneously at that time, and to see how they sort of tacked back and forth and running on parallel tracks and ultimately become connected one to the other. I mean, one thing that's important to just note historically is that the time that Roe against Wade came before the court in the early 1970s, the Supreme Court hadn't yet developed a jurisprudence of women's rights, of sex discrimination. There was no sort of constitutional framework for thinking about sex discrimination. That came later. That came in the mid to late 70s. And so it was only after that that they could start converging. On your second question, what would Harry Blackmun think about the medical marijuana case? Now, of course, the decision that the court issued in that case wasn't on the wisdom of the policy of medical marijuana. It was a response to a lower court decision that on federalism grounds, on states' rights grounds, had said that Congress had no authority to enforce federal drug law across the border of California in medical marijuana, because the marijuana grown and distributed for medical purposes was not in the stream of commerce, and consequently Congress's authority under the Commerce Clause to regulate it was non-existent. You know, I don't honestly know what Blackmun would have thought about that as a matter of constitutional law, which is what the court was dealing with. As a matter of policy, I have to assume, because he really did put very high stock in medical judgment. He had been the general counsel of the Mayo Clinic at a very crucial time in his career as a practicing lawyer, and that really influenced the way he looked at things. I have to think that he would go along with the doctors who thought that this was an appropriate use of medical discretion.
I would mention that the court did decide that controlling gun sales around high schools didn't fall under the provision of commerce because it was localized, and that as far as the medical marijuana, of course, the decision was narrow, but in fact, the main issue really has nothing, is really not based upon what individuals can do, because the federal government licenses doctors and can take away doctors' licenses. So it is a federal issue, although I know the court very carefully distinguished it. Would he be distressed, Blackmun, to realize that what he started was distorted? Was he pleased that he had changed the focus into women's right, or would he wish that they had kept making their decisions based upon what his original basis was? And I'll hang up and listen. Thank you.
Okay. I think he was satisfied with the way things turned out in the end, because he was quite a reluctant camper along the way, along the path towards women's rights, but by the end of his career, he was quite fully on board, and I think he thought that was the right position.
Let's take another call. A listener in Eureka, line 4, hi. Line 4, no? Okay, let's go on next to a caller in Champaign County on line 2, hi.
Oh, sorry about that. I wanted to ask about who wrote the Griswold versus Connecticut, because that's really where the privacy argument was introduced, and it was introduced also in Roe v. Wade. Was he already on when?
No, Harry Blackmun was not on the court in 1965 when the Griswold case was decided.
I see. But that really was the one whether Connecticut could stop married couples from buying. It was tested with married couples. It wasn't tested with just consenting adults. So,
right.
That introduced the whole privacy argument, right? I mean,
it did.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if you have anything more expanded. I have another question about Sandra Day, and that is the fact I think Specter came a little bit out of the blue saying that she should be appointed to be Chief Justice. And my understanding, and though I haven't heard a whole lot of discussion of it, is that her husband is ill, and she, at the time of the last election, she talked about how she wanted to go back to Arizona when a Republican could appoint a replacement. But I think she also wanted to be the first woman Chief Justice in a big way, and it seems to me that Rehnquist is rather dedicated to keep his former law school classmate from doing that. It looks to me. I don't know what do you hear about that?
Well, again, I'm not inside anybody's head. I don't think I agree with you. I think she would have at one point been very happy to become Chief Justice. What exactly when that point was, I'm not sure. I don't think that's the case now, because she is leaving a job that she really likes because she feels her husband needs her. I don't think that Chief Justice Rehnquist is hanging in there in order to deprive Sandra O'Connor of the right or the opportunity to succeed him. I think he's hanging in there because he feels he can do the job, and he feels it's a more productive use of his time and talents and remaining energy than quitting and going home to die. But that's just my layperson's observation of the matter.
Well, also, if he had already resigned, wouldn't there be pressure to ask O'Connor to stay as Chief Justice by a variety of Specter represents some liberal Republicans that would have liked to have had that been the case, but this obviates the need to make the decision to have the...
Yes, and of course, she couldn't just sort of stay on as Chief Justice. That requires a separate nomination, confirmation, creates a new vacancy. You know, it's a little more complicated than I think Specter's off-the-cuff remark made it seem.
Well, I think there's more to be written about that, and maybe we won't until all the papers are divulged later, if anybody's committing that to that kind of sub rosa stuff to paper. Thank you.
Thanks for the call, and let's go on now to a listener in Eureka on line 4. Hi.
Hi, good afternoon. Interesting conversation. One of the things that fascinates me, I guess, is maybe the unpredictability, the erratic non-categorization that when judges are nominated and how they will vote. For example, I believe President Eisenhower said his biggest regret was appointing Earl Warren. And then I think, as you mentioned, that the Roe v. Wade case was, I believe, produced by a predominantly Republican-oriented court. Could you comment on that?
Yeah, well, it certainly is an observed phenomenon, really throughout history, that presidents and political parties are often, you know, pretty surprised by how the people they consider there, I put the there in quotations, justices, turn out. And, you know, there's many reasons for this. And one is that things just look different once you're on the Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. Even if you've been a lower court judge with an extensive record and a lot of exposure to these issues, you know, once you get on the Supreme Court, kind of all bets are off. And it's not uncommon that people take a fresh look at what had been their settled assumptions. Another factor is that the issues change. I mean, justices can sit for 10 or 20 or 30 years, usually far outlasting the president who named them or the political moment that produced that nomination. So issues may come up, for instance, the whole federalism revival, states' rights that's been going on the last 2 years. I don't think there's a single sitting justice today who was asked a question about that during their confirmation hearings, because that set of issues just wasn't on anybody's mind. It wasn't on the table. So that kind of thing can happen, too.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Let's talk with another listener, a caller in Indiana on line one. Good afternoon.
Hello.
Hi.
Do you have the address of a medical museum? I have some instruments here from 1925.
That's not appropriate to the conversation that we're having today, and I can't help this listener out. Let's go on. Let's reintroduce our guest this afternoon, Linda Greenhouse. She is the author of Becoming Justice Blackmun, Harry Blackmun's Supreme Court Journey. Let's go back into history, and we're talking about issues changing. Harry Blackmun, before he was nominated by Richard Nixon to serve on the Supreme Court, he served on the federal appeals in the federal appeals court system in the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals. And you point out that when he took his seat on the bench in St. Louis in 1959, it was a challenging time to be a federal judge. Many areas of American law were in flux, and one of the issues the courts were grappling with in the 1960s was the death penalty. This is very interesting about Becoming Justice Blackmun. Would you please talk about Blackmun and the death penalty?
Yes, and I know this is a hot subject.
In Illinois.
In Illinois, right. He grew up in Minnesota. Minnesota hadn't had a death penalty since the early years of the 1900s. And so he grew up in a culture that really wasn't very familiar with the death penalty. And his first confrontation with it really was as a sitting federal appeals court judge, as you said. And at that time, in the 50s and then into the 60s, there was a lot of ferment about the death penalty. A lot of cases were being brought challenging the constitutionality and so on. But the law of the land was the death penalty was clearly at that time constitutional. So it was his obligation as a judge to enforce it. And he wrestled with this because he really was very uncomfortable about it. And there was one case that where I found his notes, and they were very, he kept notes on the Eighth Circuit as well as on the Supreme Court. It was really very interesting. He added a statement to the end of an opinion that he wrote for a majority of the court affirming a death sentence, which he said that he personally didn't think that a death sentence was appropriate in this case. It was a very sad and troubling case of a young man who obviously was mentally disturbed. And he was suggesting that executive clemency might really be the best way to deal with this. Well, two other judges on the court said, if you keep that statement in, we don't think that's appropriate. We can't sign your opinion. And it became a very heated issue within the court, and Blackmun receded. He withdrew his statement, and he regretted that for the rest of his life. He would refer to it with some regularity. When he came on the Supreme Court, in 1970, the death penalty issue was really heating up, and in fact, that was the big constitutional controversy that was going on in the country, not abortion, which was just sort of a cloud on the horizon, but the death penalty. And the question of the constitutionality of the death penalty was his first big encounter with a controversial constitutional issue. And the majority of the court struck down every death penalty law in the country, in the Furman case in 1972 when Blackmun dissented. He said, I don't like the death penalty, but my view of my role as a judge is not to import my personal opinion into my constitutional interpretation. So he was a dissenter. And what's so interesting about his ensuing career, he stayed on the court for 22 years after that, is to watch his constant grappling with this issue and his eventual coming out on the other side. And in one of his famous and final statements a few months before he retired in 1994, he issued a dissenting opinion in which he said that the death penalty experiment, as he put it, has failed, and I shall no longer tinker with the machinery of death. Mm. It's really quite a dramatic part of his journey.
Yeah. Harry Blackmun and Warren Burger were childhood friends, and they served together on the court. Burger was Chief Justice. Would you talk with us about their friendship, the arc of their friendship, and how it was that Harry Blackmun found his voice, essentially, on the court?
Yeah, it's an amazing tale. You couldn't make it up, really. These two guys grew up as childhood friends, two kids from quite poor families, the wrong side of the tracks in St. Paul, Minnesota. They met at the age of six in kindergarten, and they tracked each other all through school. Blackmun went away and went to Harvard, Harvard College, and Harvard Law School. Burger didn't have the money to do that, and he stayed behind in Minnesota, but they were very close. Blackmun was best man at Burger's wedding. Burger then goes off to Washington to join the Eisenhower administration, becomes a federal appeals court judge. Blackmun becomes a federal appeals court judge in the Midwest. They keep writing, and there's just a trove of correspondence. You can track the relationship at its in the height of its intensity and intimacy in the 1950s and 60s before they join each other on the Supreme Court. Burger becomes Chief Justice in 69. The next year, Blackmun joins him, and then something really strange and sad happens. I think what happens is each one had a kind of a romantic image in his mind of the other and what the other one was going to do for him and so on. And it just didn't work out that way. Neither was the man the other one thought he was. They drifted apart. They saw things differently. They had very different styles. Burger was rather patronizing toward Blackmun and kind of assumed that he would always vote his way and be at his right hand. Blackmun, by that time, was 61 years old. He had a distinguished record as a judge. He didn't want to be in anybody's, assumed to be in anybody's pocket. And they just became very different individuals. And by the end of this period, they were so estranged that they were barely speaking. It's quite a tale.
Yeah. It's interesting, isn't it, that someone can come to the court and be of an age, generally speaking here. I mean, when Harry Blackmun went to the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals in St. Louis, he was 51, right?
Yes.
And so he's 61, essentially, 62 when he goes to the Supreme Court.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't it interesting to see how people change even at that point in their life?
Oh, it is. And you know, this goes back to the early caller's question on the show. People do change, and I think it's in part because you get a very different perspective on these issues when you're sitting on the Supreme Court. I mean, you have to pay attention to precedent, of course, and to the facts of the case and everything like that. But really, at the end of the day, the future of constitutional law is in your hands. And it's an awesome responsibility, and it does change people.
Hmm. Harry Blackmun didn't jump at the chance to serve on the appeals court when he was tapped for that in 1959. He drew up a list of pros and cons, and then he did the same thing when he was asked to serve on the Supreme Court. What did Blackmun put on those lists as he tried to determine whether to accept the appointment to the appeals court in 1959 and the Supreme Court in 1970?
Well, he was a very risk-averse person. He really didn't seek change, didn't like change, was quite happy where he was. At that point, he was general counsel of the Mayo Clinic. So he was weighing the pluses and minuses. One big minus was that he would have to take a pay cut to be a federal judge. Federal judges back then made something like, I'm guessing now, but something in the order of $30,000 a year. And he was making, you know, I think close to twice that. at Mayo, and he felt that he'd be isolated, he'd be cut off from his community and that kind of thing. On the other hand, it was a great honor. He loved the legal profession. It was a chance to serve. He was attracted to public service, and you know, these were his pros and cons. When he got sounded out by the Nixon administration for the Supreme Court, he took a plane to Washington to meet with Attorney General John Mitchell, and he took out his pad and started making his pros and cons, and he listed the cons, and he didn't have any pros. He really, in a fundamental way, didn't want to do it. And somebody said to me not too long ago that the reason, part of the reason for the estrangement between Blackmun and Berger was because Berger, who had definitely had a hand in Blackmun getting the Supreme Court appointment, felt that Blackmun should have at least thanked him, and he never got any thanks. And I said in response to this, I'm not sure Blackmun thought he had anything to thank Berger for. He never was really all that happy on the Supreme Court.
Interesting. What does the act of making these lists tell us about the temperament of Harry Blackmun, other than that he was a rather conservative fellow?
Well, that he was, as I say, risk averse, and just was not ambitious in that way. He wasn't really out for anything in particular. He had a family. He had three daughters who, at the time he went on the appeals court, were still living at home, and really wasn't looking for the disruption.
What was the relationship like between Blackmun and Rehnquist?
Well, they met in a very interesting way. When Blackmun accepted the nomination for the Supreme Court, his handler, the young lawyer in the Nixon Justice Department who was assigned to walk him through the nomination process, and in fact who had earlier been assigned to check out his record on the Eighth Circuit and make a recommendation as to whether he was the type of nominee President Nixon would like to have, was William Rehnquist, who was then an assistant attorney general in the Justice Department. And they hit it off and really always kept a rather warm relationship. There's some correspondence back and forth and memos and so on. And I think Blackmun appreciated Rehnquist. He had a nice, direct manner about him and a decent sense of humor. I think they did get along pretty well.
What are relationships generally like between justices? Are they fairly cordial, or how do they communicate? How do they get one another's views on a case as they develop opinions?
How do they communicate? Well, as the Blackmun papers show us, they communicate on paper.
Yeah.
They really believe that it's much better to put things down in writing when you'd be very specific and very clear. So there's a great paper trail of the way they communicate. And by memo, by draft opinion, by the time a decision comes out of the Supreme Court, it's gone through a number of drafts. So, you really do get to see the development of the work. And you also get to see the responses of other justices, because the drill at the court, the prevailing way of dealing with things, is that if you're going to send a memo about a case, you send it to everybody. So everybody gets it. Everybody's in the loop all the time. It's disfavored to have a sort of a one-on-one private arrangement or private conversation, so that there's a lot of paper circulating around at any given time, even in this day of email. My impression is that they still put things down on paper.
All this paper communication, were there times of great stress, and do you see that as the memos go back and forth?
Oh, yeah. I mean, a lot of the stress revolved around abortion because, although, as I said earlier, the original vote in Roe was 7-2, that margin eroded as times went on and new people came on the court and old people left and so on. And Blackmun was often in great distress about the future of the right to abortion. So you'll see him drafting dissenting opinions when he thinks that Roe is going to be overturned, which of course it never ultimately was, but there are drafts of opinions that he wrote on that assumption and this kind of thing. So you do see a lot of pretty emotional distress.
Yeah. How did the Watergate crisis affect the court?
Well, that was early in his tenure, 1974. The question was, would the president have to turn over the tapes that had been subpoenaed by the Watergate special prosecutor? And the court decided unanimously that he would, that there was no executive privilege that could be brought to bear to shield the president from that kind of judicial process. The question was how to write the opinion. And that was a very fast-moving, stressful time. Warren Burger, the Chief Justice, assigned the opinion to himself, as was his prerogative. But he was having a hard time sort of getting it going. And so there was almost like a little rump caucus of the other justices. And they sort of parceled out the work among themselves. And Blackmun was given a piece of it, and he was also given the unpleasant assignment of going to his friend Warren Burger and telling him what was happening. And in later years, Blackmun said that he thought that was really sort of the beginning of the end of the friendship, that Burger took it very hard. I'm not sure whether that was more important than a variety of other things, but it certainly didn't help their relationship.
Yeah. How did the justices, particularly Justice Blackmun, view that period of great crisis that was confronting the country, 1974.
Well, he was very distressed about it. I mean, although the Watergate case itself was very fast-moving and was in and out of the court in a matter of weeks, it had been building up quite a long time. Blackmun gave a speech to the American Bar Association, I guess, the summer before, so the summer of 73, in which he really spoke very openly about his distress at the kind of moral climate in Washington with what was going on in the Nixon administration. So, you know, these were people living in the world of their times, and they were certainly aware of what was happening.
Hmm. You wrote an article for the New York Times that appeared just this past Sunday, July 10th, about the history of the current court, and this was really fascinating. You wrote about what's called the feedback loop, you know, the influence lower courts exert on the Supreme Court.
Right, thank
and you. I have the paper here, and before time is out, I wanted to ask you about this. You report it's the lower courts that have to make sense of the Supreme Court's opinions and to apply them in new factual contexts. It's a feedback loop, said Susanna Sherry, a professor at Vanderbilt University Law School. You see how your opinions are actually working. You see the problems they create. This court has signaled very clearly that it wanted to move in particular directions. Some of the lower courts took those directions and went further. Has there always been a feedback loop when it comes to the court?
Oh, sure. No, I think there never really has to be, because every case brings up its new set of facts. And, if the case was exactly the same, it really wouldn't be moving up the judicial process. It would get summary judgment or something like that. So judges always have to apply their understanding of the law to a new set of facts, and that creates new conflicts, and that can go back up to the Supreme Court. And it's a feedback, I think, was a good image, but also it's think of it as a dialogue, just a constant back and forth over. That's how our law develops.
Hmm. It also underscores the importance of who's on the lower courts, doesn't it?
Oh, yes, sure. The Supreme Court only hears about 75 or 80 cases a year, and there are tens of thousands of cases that move through the federal courts and that produce decisions that never get reviewed by the Supreme Court. So, sure, it's very important who's on the lower courts.
Well, let's go back to Sandra Day O'Connor here. At her confirmation hearings in 81, when she was asked about a hot topic, a topic like abortion, she said, "I do not believe as a nominee I could tell you how I would vote." Is such a response possible today?
Oh, we'll probably hear something like that. Yeah. I think it, it's not only possible, I would predict it, unless somebody's actually, you know, written something or decided a case in a way that they can't really duck behind that. She didn't have much of a record on anything, but that seems to be the mantra, not to be pinned down.
Yeah. How do you think Harry Blackmun would see the current Supreme Court, how do you think he might view the current struggle, the anticipated confirmation battle that's looming?
Oh, I think he'd be distressed about it. I think the current members of the court are distressed about it. I've heard Justice O'Connor express her dismay about how politicized and kind of toxic everything has been. It doesn't please anybody, let me put it that way.
Hmm. We talked about Roe. We've talked about the death penalty. What else is there in Harry Blackmun's legacy that we should be aware of?
Well, I think, you know, since he's the last justice who actually left the court, so it's kind of, it feels like ancient history, but it's really pretty recent. I think his life is worth considering for the reasons we touched on earlier. You put somebody on the Supreme Court, and over time they become somebody quite different, perhaps. I mean, his evolution was more dramatic than some, but it really wasn't unique. I mean, you can look at Justice O'Connor in this light. Actually, she ended up with positions that would not at all have been predicted earlier. You know, in the same article that you just quoted that I wrote last Sunday, mm-hmm. about the feedback loop, I quote an article that Justice O'Connor wrote in tribute to Thurgood Marshall after he retired. It was published back in 1992, where she talked about Thurgood Marshall having a profound influence on her, and that the stories that he would sit at the conference table and tell from his life in the civil rights movement would, she said, perhaps change the way I see the world. But at the time that she wrote this, it seemed a little odd because she was quite conservative. Her jurisprudence really didn't seem to be reflecting much of that at all. Then fast forward 10 years, and she writes the majority opinion in the University of Michigan case that upholds affirmative action in university admissions, and she really became quite a different judge than she had been 10 years earlier, and she served on the court for more than 20 years. So it's really worth considering these people's lives and you know, what they bring to the court, and then also what kind of influence the court exerts on them.
Yeah, very interesting. Was there anything that, when you were going through the papers a couple of years back, that is there anything that really stood out, that really surprised you?
Well, there were a number of things. Of course, I had covered the court for a chunk of this period. I started covering the court in 1978.
Yeah.
So it gave me the chance to actually pick up some of the case files, the actual files of cases that I had covered that had always sort of baffled me, that had given me the idea that, you know, there's something going on there behind the scenes and I just don't know what it is. And so that was, just on a personal level, was very interesting and quite a lot of fun to be able to peel back the curtain and see what was happening in some of these cases. And I was quite surprised by some of them. There was one particular case late in the Berger years, when Berger was Chief Justice, and the court was quite dysfunctional, where the court had not been able to decide it. They had to set it over for a second year. They re-argued it. They finally decided it by a vote of 7-2, a case called Chadha. And I always wondered, well, what was that all about? It's unusual that the court can't decide a case and carries it over for another term. And it turned out that it was just a case that Warren Berger was so nonplussed by that he never got around the first time to assigning an opinion. So a whole term of court went by and there was never an opinion circulating. So the last day of the court came and of course they couldn't decide it. Nobody was working on it. So that sort of thing I found very, very interesting. And it's just the back and forth among the justices, the intensity of the interaction, the care that they take. I'll sign your opinion, but only if you remove this phrase or this word or this comma. These are people who, unlike maybe some of our public officials, really do stand behind their work. They put their name on it. They're accountable for it. And they're not going to sign anything that doesn't feel right to them. Mm-hmm. So I thought that was pretty interesting.
Yeah. There we have to leave it. Linda Greenhouse, thank you so much for talking with me this afternoon, talking with our listeners.
Okay, thank you.
Linda Greenhouse has been our guest this afternoon in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. She is a writer, a senior writer for the New York Times. She covers the U.S. Supreme Court for the newspaper. She's worked on that beat since 1978. She won the Pulitzer Prize in 1998 for her coverage of the court. And she is the author of Becoming Justice Blackmun, Harry Blackmun's Supreme Court Journey. The book is published by Times Books. 9 minutes before 2 o'clock, settlement prices should be in now from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Hey, just when you thought that they were going to go down for the end of the season, no way. Came roaring back today at the Chicago Board of Trade, Celeste. And the reason? Simply, again, the weather market. The idea is that it's going to be dry and normal and warm across much of the Midwest, and certainly that in the state of Illinois, the rains did fall, but not in the driest areas. And there's a great deal of talk about how much the crop has been impacted already by the dry weather, and that there will be many fields in the northern portion of the state that if they don't get rainfall much more than they've already had, and some of them haven't had any at all in this last crew, if they don't get rainfall, that they won't make very much of a crop, if they make a crop at all. In fact, we'll talk about that just a little bit later today during the closing market report. I have an excerpt from tomorrow's article from Emerson Nafziger, agronomist here at the University of Illinois, talking about just that, what he assesses this year's corn crop to be in the state of Illinois. And there's a good way to figure just about what your bushels might be as well on your farm. So stay with us with the closing market report this afternoon. That comes to you at 6 after the hour of 2 o'clock today. As I said, futures at the Chicago Board of Trade roaring back today. The beans up 13 in the July. That's the nearby Novembers. We're up 12.5. Corn futures up 8 and 9 and 10 cents for the day. And in the wheat pit, futures were 7 and 8 cents higher from that wheat pit. In fact, July contract had a high today of 333.5, the low at 326. Settlement price there at $3.32. They were up 8 and a quarter on the day. September futures, 341.5, the high, the low at 331.5. Settlement price, 339.75, up 7.25. In December contract, 355.25, the high, the low at 345.5. Settlement price at 353.5, up 8 cents for the day. March futures up 7.25 at the Chicago Board of Trade. Soft red winter wheat March futures contract at 367, high, low at 358. Settlement price at 365.75, up 7.25. Next year's May contract, no high, no low, but we do have a settlement price at $3.70 even. And they were up 7 for the day from the corn pit. This is in the leader's seat for the day. Up 10.25 in the July corn. 238.5, the high, the low at 227.5. Settlement price there, $2.37. September futures, 247, the high, the low at 235.5. Settlement price at 244.75, up 9.25 in the ever important December contract. Your new crop corn, $2.58, the high, the low at 247.25, and the settlement price at 256.25. It finished 9.25 higher for the day. March futures, 264.5, the high, the low at 254.25, settled at 262.75, up 8.5. And the main contract in the corn pit, 267, the high, the low at 260.5, settled 265.5. They were up 7.5 cents. July futures were up 7.5 as well, with a high of 69, a low at 63.5. And next year's 2006 July corn futures settled at $2.68 a bushel. Once again, they were up 7.5 for the day. July oats, 175, the high, the low at 172. Settlement price there at $1.74. They were up 1 cent. September futures up 3.75, 179, the high, the low at 75, and a settlement price for the September oats at $1.78.5. Once again, up 3.75. From the soy complex now, July soybeans, $7.17 the high, the low at 701, settled 7.11.5. They were up 13 for the day. August futures, 720, the high, the low at 703. Settled at 714, up 12.75. In September contract in the bean pit, 723.5, the high, the low at 707.5. Settlement price at 716.75, up 11.75. November futures, 731.5, the high, the low at 713. Settled 725, up 12.5. And January's 731.5, the high, the low at 717.5. Settled 725.5. They were up 13 for the day. March futures 722.5 on the high side. The March beans, the low at 709, and settlement price at $7.17.5. They were up 12 for the day. Bean meal, July futures, $225.50. The high, the low at $219.50. The settlement price at $222 a short ton, up $2.80. And the August contract, $225. The high, the low at $219.20. Settled $221.20. They were up $230 for the day. July bean oil, $25.70. The high, the low at $25.01. Settled $25.35, up $34. And the August bean oil, $25.71. The high, the low at $25.10. August soybean oil, settled $25.43. Up 39 for the day. Now here's Celeste Quinn with the numbers from the Mercantile Exchange.
Thank you, Todd. Feeder cattle finished lower today. Everything else, with the exception of one contract in lean hogs, finished higher. August feeder cattle, 109.95, the high 108.60, the low, the settlement 109.55, that down 10. September 108.80, the high 107.40, the low 108.45, the settlement, that down 30. October 107.25, the high, the low 106 even, the settlement 107.17.5, down 7.5. August live cattle, 79.20, the high 78.30, the low 79.12.5, the settlement, that up 60. October 82.20, the high, the low 81.25, the settlement 82.15, that up 25. July lean hog, 68.70, the high 68.20, the low 68.42.5, the settlement, that up 35. August 67.10, the high 66.20, the low, the settlement 66.85, that up 80. October lean hogs, 58.60, the high, the low, 58 even, the settlement 58.25, that down a nickel. December lean hogs, 55.65, the high, 55.25, the low, 55.40, the settlement, that finishing up 22.5. July pork belly, 64.22.5, the high, the low, 62.75, the settlement 64.22.5, that up $2. Let's take a look now at what's happening on Wall Street. The Dow up 37 points. The NASDAQ off a fraction. The S&P 500 is up 1. The Dow stands at 10,551. The NASDAQ 2143. The S&P 500 1223.
Agricultural information is made possible with support from ADM, helping to create a storehouse of possibilities and products from a single seed. ADM, resourceful by nature.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Annie O'Keefe from Webster Groves, Missouri writes, "Dear Dr. Science, what colors attract a child's attention most? Do some colors encourage learning better than others?"
You are one lucky woman, especially if you plan on raising a family with this man. His intense desire to both parent and nurture has found expression in a physical protuberance, no matter how small. As a child, he may have been deeply influenced by the Dr. Seuss book, Horton Hatchet.